This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. More at techponte.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, as the world gets hotter, how will the U.S. military adapt to fighting in hotter, harsher battlefields? Texans are being asked to vote to bring water to forgotten parts of the state, and environmental activists want Port Aransas to stay wild. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The world's rising heat is creating a serious problem for the United States military, despite the fact that the commander-in-chief, President Donald Trump, calls climate change a hoax. The Pentagon sees it as a very real threat. The Worldwide Threat Assessment of the U.S. Intelligence Community, an annual report on security threats to U.S. interests, concludes that global environmental and ecological degradation, as well as climate change, are likely to fuel competition for resources, economic distress, and social discontent through 2019 and beyond. Responding to a congressional order, the Defense Department issued a report in January that details how climate change will impact the Defense Department missions, operational plans, and installations. But there is another problem for the military with climate change. U.S. troops will be forced to contend with hotter, harsher conditions on the battlefield, and training for those conditions is pushing servicemen and women beyond their physical limits. In 2008, there were 1,766 cases of heat stroke or heat exhaustion diagnosed among active member service members, according to military data reported by Inside Climate News. By 2018, that figure had climbed to 2,792, an increase of almost 60% over the decade. Health impacts from heat have already cost the military as much as $1 billion from 2008 to 2018 in lost work, retraining, and medical care. A recent Department of Defense report says the warming of the planet will affect the Department of Defense's ability to defend the nation, and it poses an immediate risk to U.S. national security. David Hassmeyer is a staff reporter for Inside Climate News.
At one point last week, more than 20 million people in 36 states, you know, were under heat warnings and heat advisories, and that's in the United States. And Europe, India, Australia, worldwide, heat waves and average temperatures are increasing. So that's the backdrop for what's happening with the military and how the military is being affected by climate change and increasing temperatures.
But as the world warms up, it's a destabilizing factor for nations and regions around the world. That means there's going to be more conflict. The soldiers, other military men and women are going to have to adapt to a battlefield that's hotter.
Correct. And, you know, climate change and increasing temperatures are something that the Department of Defense acknowledges. The Department of Defense issued a report a few years ago that said climate change with heat is one of its most harsh elements. And I think the report said something to the effect that will affect the Department of Defense's ability to defend the nation and poses kind of that immediate risk to national security that you've just been mentioning. You know, essentially, in this context, heat becomes a threat multiplier. It's a peril that the DOD also acknowledges because it has that potential to exacerbate, you know, many of the challenges that the military is already facing, you know, in some of the world's most destabilized regions.
So the military is going to be going into these very harsh areas. The Middle East, they have got to be able to deal with those conditions. But you're finding out and you're reporting that we have troops that are dying of heat exposure during their training exercises. This needs to be addressed.
It does. In fact, the Defense Health Agency does an annual report that looks at heat illnesses, primarily heat exhaustion and heat stroke. And one of the things that it has found is that over the last decade, the number of military personnel who have been sickened by the heat has been increasing. In about 2013, between 2013 and 2018, the Defense Health Agency counted more than 10,000 heat-related illnesses at about 250 military installations, primarily in the United States, but worldwide.
There is the mission. The mission. You have to be able to defend the country. You have to be able to provide support in some of the harshest environments in the world. You can't call off the war because it's hot today. So our military is what? They're responding to this. They're trying to figure out how can we adapt to it, because typically you're going to be going into an environment where the local, whoever you're fighting, if they're from that region, they already know it's hot. So we got to be able to deal with them on that battlefield, right?
Correct, and you're absolutely right. The military is faced with really two competing challenges here. One, training and keeping its personnel safe. It has to keep the personnel safe, yet do the type of training so that those personnel will be mission ready when they have to go into those regions. And it's what the military is struggling with now, is trying to find a way to develop a sustainable, comprehensive strategy to how to train in these conditions while keeping their personnel safe. One of the former military people I interviewed is a former Army Surgeon General. And what he said is that heat injuries are among the most vexing environmental problems the military faces. And he said that almost all of them are preventable, and none really need to be fatal. But David, you have to understand there is a vast difference between the military and the civilian population. The military does a very good job of tracking heat injuries and heat deaths, whereas in the civilian population, there's not a centralized way to track these. The Center for Disease Control relies on anecdotal evidence. So the military is pretty specific when it says, you know, in a 10-year period, more than 10,000 service members have suffered heat injuries. It's going to be a pretty accurate count, because the military is very demanding and of accountability in this area. So it's really difficult to try to draw a parallel between the military and the civilian population, whereas it is very difficult to track numbers in the civilian population.
So what is a black flag warning?
A black flag warning is basically the military's way of saying the heat and the heat index. And the heat index is a combination of the ambient temperature and the humidity. And that's the military's way of saying if it's black flag, it means that the conditions are dangerous for troops, and suggests a minimum work-rest period of 40 minutes of rest for every hour that troops are training. And it can go up to as much as resting 50 minutes out of every hour, depending on the circumstances.
And then also providing what, water or cooling or anything?
Yes, and that's part of it. It's hydration. It is finding the shade. And the military has some very specific guidelines on hydration. It does not want its soldiers to overhydrate. In fact, at least three of those 17 deaths came as a result of military personnel overhydrating. They drank too much, and it washed the electrolytes out of their system and caused their body to react to excess fluids. They still died of heat, but the cause was overhydration.
Obviously, then there needs to be sophisticated and trained personnel who understands the complications of dealing with soldiers who are carrying a lot of weight in the heat, and their bodies are reacting. We got to be able to figure out what's going on with these guys.
And that's what's happening at the Army's Fort Benning hospital facility in Georgia. The hospital there has established a heat center, and it's a specialized medical unit that is being established to develop new preventive measures to mitigate heat stress, heat illnesses, establishing guidelines for assessing heat risks, and setting protocols for how soldiers are treated for heat.
So the world is going to be more chaotic and more destabilized because of climate change, and there doesn't seem to be any interest in trying to deal with that and mitigate that. And so the military is going to be called upon to try to exert U.S. political will around the world, and that's going to happen probably a lot more frequently. We're going to have to go into places that are a lot hotter, a lot more harsh environments, and we have to train these military men and women under circumstances that make them battle ready, so that they're going to be training under circumstances that closely mimic those what it's going to be like on that battlefield, that hot, harsh battlefield. I don't see how you can do that without allowing for that there's going to be some troops are going to die of heat exposure along the way.
In talking with a number of current military personnel as well as former military personnel, they acknowledge that it is a very fine line to train the military personnel to be ready to address these issues under very extreme heat conditions, but yet still trying to safeguard them. One of the Defense Department's medical persons I talked to used the analogy that they need to be careful because out in deployment, a heat injury is akin to a battlefield casualty, and it has a ripple effect. When a military person falls to heat, that person can no longer do their job. So it means somebody's going to have to step in and do it for them. It means that other military personnel are going to have to care for that stricken individual. So it has this cascading effect when someone is struck down by a heat illness.
And so the military is aware of this. They're working the problem.
Yes, they are. But the biggest issue that the military has to overcome, and it's kind of the foundation of this heat center at Fort Benning, is that the military has to come up with a sustainable strategy. When there is a death, for example, the military reacts very quickly, very responsibly to that. In most cases, they have safety stand-downs where they stop the training and then they try to figure out what went wrong. And they try to implement policies or make sure the existing policies cover the safety issues. What happens is that after that stand-down, after that initial reaction to it, that death, that instant, has a way of fading away, and it becomes back into the routine. One of the doctors at the heat center in Fort Benning I talked to described it as a tragedy loop. When there is an incident, it is addressed very quickly, but then that institutional knowledge fades. Because of demands for training, because of personnel turnover, and then all of a sudden it just loops back around and there's another death, another tragedy.
David Hassmeyer is a staff reporter for Inside Climate News. His story is U.S. soldiers falling ill, dying in the heat as climate warms. This week, numbers 1 through 10 were pulled from a brown felt cowboy hat And that was how Texas decided the ballot places for 10 proposed amendments to the Texas Constitution. These were issues passed in the recent legislative session, but they also require voter approval. Come November, you're going to have your say. Prop 4 will likely get the most attention. It will prohibit the imposition of an individual income tax in Texas. There are other props that range from providing more funding for cancer research, funding for state parks, and flood infrastructure. But some in Texas will be watching closely Prop 2. That is a proposal to establish the Economically Distressed Areas Program, which provides financial assistance for programs to develop water and wastewater services in economically distressed areas where those services don't meet minimum state standard. Representative Mary Gonzalez of El Paso has been a leader in getting that issue onto the ballot.
So Prop 2. Prop 2 is a good number to get.
It's a great number.
So you like Prop 2?
Yes, sir. We're very excited. I mean, we're mostly excited because this is a very transformative proposition for Texas.
So tell me more.
Well, you know, there's thousands of Texans across the state in rural and low-income communities that don't have access to clean water or wastewater infrastructure. What I talk about is that there are Texans that don't even have the ability to flush their own toilets. This will never change unless we reauthorize the only program that has been able to create this transformative change, and that's the Economically Distressed Areas Program. And so we have to refund it. That means it has to be a constitutional amendment, and that means Texans get a vote on it in November to say, hey, everybody should have clean water and a wastewater infrastructure.
So about 400,000 Texans now are living in areas that don't have basic water and waste infrastructure. Where are these people living? Is it across the state?
It is across the state, everywhere from outside of Houston to outside in my district in El Paso. Literally, we heard stories from all over East Texas, West Texas, rural, urban. This is a problem that we just need to address, but these projects just cost so much money. And for some local communities to find the resources, it's just nearly impossible. And so that's why we needed the state to intervene. We've been doing a great job. We have to keep the ball moving forward.
How is it that people are living in these basically third world conditions?
Well, I mean, I think just like a lot of people, they figure out how to survive, right? I'll give an example where I live. My father hauls his water in, and he gets that delivered about every couple weeks. Or other communities are struggling because they don't have wastewater infrastructure. There's a community called Montana Vista, for example, that they don't have wastewater infrastructure, but they have septic tanks. But the problem is that the ground that this community is on doesn't really hold septic tanks very well. So a lot of times the septic tanks become defunct. And in that, when it rains really hard, you can see raw sewage come up from the septic tanks into the streets. And so, like, you just have these really awful conditions in parts of Texas. And, again, we can come together in a bipartisan way to say, hey, everybody should have clean water and wastewater infrastructure.
So you're not just talking about colonias along the Texas-Mexico border. We're also talking about areas in East Texas. Some of these places have been inhabited by people for quite a long time, and they were always overlooked, never funded. They had no way to get these dollars before.
Exactly. So they were overlooked, never funded, or didn't have enough of a tax base and population to accumulate the money necessary to do these million-dollar projects, right? And so that's when the state comes in and says, hey, we can help out in these smaller, more rural or more low-income communities.
And if this $200 million, that's what the bond is funding, how are those dollars going to be leveraged?
So what happens is the program exists right now, and the way it works is that it's a program in the Texas Water Development Board, a state agency, and they receive applications from local communities saying, here's what our need is, and then they judge who has the highest need and in order to get funding for their projects.
And when it goes onto the ballot, we're going to have 10 propositions going before Texans. Do you think that Texans are going to really kind of drill down and try and figure out like which props I should vote for, or how do you think they're going to be looking at this slate of questions before them?
Well, I hope the Texans are, A, going to go vote in these very important constitutional amendments, and B, that they do take the time to know what they're voting for, and that's why we are trying to educate voters. My office, we created a PAC, Turn on the Tap Texas, to help inform voters about Prop 2 specifically and why it's important for our state.
Are you going to appeal to voters in Texas, hoping to get them to go vote for this out of a sense of compassion and responsibility to their fellow Texans? Because you're really talking about providing essential services to very isolated parts of the state that typically don't have a voice.
Exactly. So that's why we have the statewide PAC, because we want to make sure people really understand, like, hey, this is going to impact you. And, you know, and people will say, well, it maybe doesn't help me in my community, like, but I would say it helps everybody across the state, and we should never want anybody in our state not to have water or wastewater infrastructure.
State Representative Mary Gonzalez, a Democrat representing El Paso, is backing Proposition 2 on the November ballot, which would provide funds for water projects in economically distressed parts of Texas. If you go for your summer trip to the Texas coast, to Port Aransas, and you see a bunch of signs and flags that say, "Keep her wild," here's what that's about. Residents are fighting multiple plans to bring industrial development to the area that they fear will ruin Port A that they and many other Texans love. Tammy King is a board member of the Port Aransas Conservancy and a member of Keep Her Wild.
We are Port Aransas Conservancy, and we formed last year in reaction to the industrial development of Harbor Island and the potential 75-foot dredge of the Corpus Christi Ship Channel starting right here in Port Aransas, and potential VLCC berth across from the town, or in the city limits of Port Aransas and across from our city park.
Y'all are looking at a lot of industrial activity that's being proposed and being planned for parts of Port Aransas that currently have been pretty much left alone, right?
Yes. In the past, it was an oil export terminal, but it was a horrendous location for hurricane, storm surge, tankers being pulled off their moorings when other tankers passed by, and spills from the tank farm. And over the years, they deactivated it and located it further up the channel in Port of Corpus Christi and at Ingleside. And now with the current oil and gas production from the Permian Basin and the Eagle Ford Shale, they're wanting to pipe it to Corpus Christi and then also out to Harbor Island. We feel like there's current existing locations that could be enhanced and that can carry this capacity. And bringing in an outside venture capitalist and private equity group to redevelop Harbor Island is unacceptable. In the middle of our Redfish Bay State Scientific Area, Mission Aransas National Estuarine Research Reserve, and it would affect the tourism economy of Port A, which relies on this natural habitat. And we just feel like that intersection at Harbor Island, where the Lydian Channel, the Aransas Channel, and the Corpus Christi Ship Channel can converge as it goes out to the open ocean, is a vital path for marine organisms to come into the bay system under shelter, can reproduce and grow and maturely then swim back out into the ocean. Crab, redfish, trout, and drum and turtles and all kinds of sport fish even. And we want to protect that natural habitat right here at this junction. Going further up the channel to Ingleside or the Port of Corpus Christi, the tidal influence is not as great. The organisms don't have the habitat up in those areas like it does right here at Port Aransas and Redfish Bay. So this is the worst possible place for this industrial development.
This area is controlled by who? Is this a private property, or is this under the control of the Port Authority?
It was purchased by the Port of Corpus Christi, and they are the ones that are seeking these venture capital groups to develop this area. They're using public funds to do that. Feels like a gold rush, trying to put as much energy sprawling these industrial areas out to see who can take advantage of the profits.
You say it's a gold rush because there's, 30 projects is what I heard, that are looking at this area?
Yes. If you look at what is existing, the current storage capacity of what's existing versus what is being planned at those existing facilities, it's more than enough facilities and holding tanks for the current oil that's coming here. Building one more site right here at a critical junction is really just not needed, because all that oil is just not coming to Corpus Christi. It still has to go to Houston, Freeport, South Padre, and there's other areas. Port of Corpus Christi is trying to bring it all to Harbor Island and put others out of business.
Now, there's talk of a desal plant, also talk of a major plastics manufacturing facility, big tank farms that are being talked about. All of these things are going to have a major impact on the environment. Is that the main concern?
Yes. And we're mainly concerned with the ones that are in the Puerto Aransas city limits and surrounding Aransas and Redfish Bay. It's in this perfect little triangle of habitat. And so tank farms near Aransas Pass, and potential other kinds of industrialization, and then the desalination plant on Harbor Island, and then the oil export terminal on Harbor Island. That's what we're the most concerned about.
A statement from the Port of Corpus Christi says that they are doing this economic development in an environmentally sensitive way.
There is no possible way that you can build an oil tanker on Harbor Island in an environmentally safe way. Accidents will happen. It's not if it happens, it's when it's going to happen.
So how do you plan on stopping it?
Well, the Port of Corpus Christi keep continually saying this is a done deal, and we disagree. They have a process to follow. They have permits to gather. They still have to find customers to sell them oil. And we do not believe the port should be using the public money to try to expedite these processes with the Corps of Engineers and PCEQ. And we are asking every Texan who is interested in this project, whether you're Republican, whether you're Democrat, if you care about Port A, if you care about the natural environment of Texas, we need to help protect and save our last great beach and bay system in Texas. We need you to call your local leaders, your state and national representatives, the governor, the Port of Corpus Christi commissioners, and say, please stop the industrialization of Harbor Island and Aransas and Redfish Bay.
Tammy King is a board member of the Port Aransas Conservancy and a member of Keep Her Wild. They are fighting a number of proposed projects that will industrialize ecologically sensitive areas around Port Aransas. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page or on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past Texas Matters programs to listen to, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.